person. This is the Devil's Advocate.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste.
Hey gang, welcome to the Devil's Advocate. Dr. K here, coming to you live from the studios of KTXT, the Raider 881 in the College of Media and Communication here at Texas Tech University. Hey, join the conversation online on social media. You can go to facebook.com/TheRaider881, or the same handle on Twitter, TheRaider881. Send us some comments. We'll take a look, see if we can get you in as part of the conversation. Hey, do you guys hear a sound? I heard a weird sound in here earlier.
Oh,
I don't know if you heard it.
So. I'm hearing it.
Yeah, we'll listen for it, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, I heard that. Made me a little nervous, too. It was like, there it is again. Do you hear it?
Is that you, Ted Cruz?
Oh, that's it.
Oh, God.
I'm scared. That just doesn't sound good at all.
Hold me.
We looked for packages under the desk. Hold me. Nice. That's the sound of impending doom of the debt ceiling crashing the global economy.
You could have stopped this. We could have all stopped this. We shouldn't have voted them in.
It's too late for that. But they may actually have a deal. And so we're going to talk about the debt ceiling. How did you describe China earlier? I thought that was fun.
Oh, well, apparently the Chinese leadership, once again, in all its glorious wisdom, has, due to our economic downturn for the second time in 5 years, has called for another post-American world order. What that basically means is they want a sort of a multipolar system that is essentially dominated by a number of nations and not just dominated by American hegemony. So the good old days of us being in control of everything, yeah, with us being downstream like we are, it looks like those days are coming to an end if this goes the way it looks like it's going
to
go.
Nice of us to do them that favor for them on the world stage. So Matthew Riley from Political Science joining us, of course, and Reggie Rutledge is here, and we're going to talk about the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling. The clock is ticking because tomorrow is the deadline to come up with a deal for the debt ceiling, or the entire global economy melts down into a worldwide depression. But there's breaking news. Did you guys hear?
Oh, yes, sir, I did. Yeah. Apparently, senators at last have agreed on a deal to avert defaulting on the debt ceiling. I heard it's being worked on in the Senate. We don't know if it's going to pass in the House yet, but so far, with things getting as desperate as they are, it might just.
I'm sure the Tea Party folks in the House won't hesitate to vote for a deal coming out of Harry Reid's Senate. You know,
not with businessmen funding their pockets. I mean, the one thing they want to keep is their business. Pals and all the way in New York, very happy. And this defaulting on our debt is not going to make them happy.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. Yeah, their campaigns won't be funded if they don't support this deal.
But it seems like this worked out in favor of Democrats more so than anything.
So the best illustration of that, thank you, Reggie, is I'm going to hold this up. I'm going to hold this up to the microphone so you can look at this picture on your radios. It's a huge picture from the White House of White House Press Secretary Jay Carney. He's got this enormous grin on his face, just absolute stunning satisfaction, which is all you need to know about this, in my opinion. And this is in honor of Anna Leavis, whose schoolwork got in the way of her schoolwork. She's taking midterm exams instead of joining the school. But the Republicans absolutely folded on this deal, and Jay Carney, Harry Reid, the president, just ecstatic.
Dr. K, I've got a quote from you I heard from a news article yesterday. Apparently, a Democratic senatorial aide was asked yesterday what the senators were going to do due to this deal passing. And they were like, look, two things are going to happen. One, the Senate isn't going to take anything the House is going to give them. Two, the Senate isn't going to take anything the House is going to give them. And that was it, basically. So right now, the Democrats, it seems like, are pretty entrenched on this issue. So we'll see how well your Republican friends will hold up with this brutal onslaught.
I think it's too late, and I no longer have any Republican friends. Let's do
They've
this.
They've all abandoned you.
Exactly.
You're bankers, sir.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well, hey, we may, if we have time, I'm going to tease you with this. We may get to talk about a new bank deal that may shock some of you.
It's kind
of
so ironic.
Kind of intriguing. We'll try to get to that so that we'll leave you hanging for another week. Jasmine Moore, our producer, spent hours and hours so that I didn't have to. Thank God. Thank you, Jasmine. Editing a beautiful montage for us this week. This is kind of fun now because in retrospect, this is a listen to Speaker of the House John Boehner and President Obama before there was a deal. And they were still throwing some elbows. So give a listen to this montage.
So the president's position that... Listen, we're not going to sit down and talk to you until you surrender is just not sustainable. It's not our system of government. The long and short of it is there's going to be a negotiation here. We can't raise the debt ceiling without doing something about what's driving us to borrow more money and to live beyond our means. It's time to have that conversation.
It's our party. We can stop what we want. We can vote how we want to fund what we want.
Red states and sweaty bodies everywhere. Bills in the house like we don't care. Cause we came to shut it all down now. No government around now.
The truth of the matter is there are enough Republican and Democratic votes in the House of Representatives right now to end the shutdown immediately with no partisan strings attached. The House should hold that vote today. If Republicans and Speaker Boehner are saying there are not enough votes, then they should prove it. Let the bill go to the floor and let's see what happens. Just vote.
The government. Shut that down.
Let every member of Congress vote their conscience, and they can determine whether or not they want to shut the government down. My suspicion is, my very strong suspicion is that there are enough votes there. And the reason that Speaker Boehner hasn't called a vote on it is because he doesn't apparently want to see the government shut down end at the moment.
The American people are worried about their jobs. They're worried about their incomes rising because they're all under pressure. The economy's not growing. Why isn't it growing? One of the issues that's standing in the way is Obamacare. The fact that nobody knows what the rules are. Employers scared to death to hire new employees, cutting the hours of many of their current employees. And for what reason?
It's our floor, we can say when we want to.
The poll on Obamacare does consistently say that huge numbers of Americans are unhappy with the law. 67% of independents in the most recent CNN poll said that they were. The problem is it worth the government shutdown? And even if Republicans have said, hey, look, we sent this bill and that bill and the other bill over to Harry Reid in the Senate, the question is at the end of a couple of weeks from now, if the government's not reopened, who's going to bear the burden?
Shut it down.
Shut down the government.
Shut it down.
Government.
Jasmine Moore, nicely done on that montage. Thank you. That was fun. So, A, I didn't have to do it this week. And B, that was really entertaining. So, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, so the I'm cracking up. And by the way, the mock Mitch McConnell in that montage. We will get to Huckleberry Hound, Senator Hound, later today. So that's in honor of Jordan LeJeune, who couldn't be here. Jordan's actually here. He's outside the window. He's trying to get in, and we won't let him because I was too depressed to have him on the show.
Does he have rabies, or is he just losing his mind?
He's just foaming at the mouth. He's just really mad because I won't
go
let
back
him
to the Senate, Jordan. It's where you belong.
Where you want. Yeah. So this deal, if you could call it a deal, was ridiculous. We were talking before the show about it. So do you guys know what the Republican concessions were for this deal? You know what they beat out of the Senate to get this deal passed?
Pride and prestige, hopefully.
They don't even have that. No. No, man. They couldn't buy a vowel. They're so broke on this deal. It's ridiculous. They just got killed. So what happened is the Senate hammered out a deal. And when Harry Reid comes out and thanks his Republican colleagues, you know it's bad news. Something bad must have happened. He ended up rolling the Republicans. So what happened is the Republicans were pushing for all kinds of things. They wanted some relief on the Affordable Care Act. So for example, members of Congress, members of big unions, a bunch of companies have gotten set asides. They've gotten at least a 1 year reprieve from the requirement, from the individual mandate. The business mandate has been postponed. That's one of the things that Ted Cruz and some of the other Tea Party members were pushing for. They also wanted to eliminate the 2.3% medical device tax. That tax is really unusual. Usually you tax profit. That tax is on all revenue for companies that make medical devices. Some people have said that could cost up to 40,000 jobs in the U.S., and medical device manufacturing may go overseas. These are things like artificial knees, stents, things like that that get manufactured and used by the tens of thousands in this country every year. So they were going to tax the revenue, not the profit, but every dollar that goes through the company was going to get taxed 2.3%. Republicans wanted to set aside on that. They got none of that. And in fact, the president late last week, instead of playing it straight, actually wanted to increase spending. He said, why don't we do this? Why don't we throw out the sequester and all of those cuts, the couple $1 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years? Why don't we eliminate those and increase all that spending again?
That's a bold move. Let's hope it works out for us.
A huge card to throw on the table. And that is the thing the Republicans negotiated on, was this obscene threat to throw out the sequester. They're like, well, let us keep the sequester in place, which was already, and the president loves to say this, the Affordable Care Act is established law. Well, the sequester deal was already signed and in place. It's established law. And that's what he was trying to unseat. So that was the compromise. The Republicans folded on everything if you just wouldn't increase spending a bunch more.
It seems like they kind of dropped the ball because they were at this point that they were backed up into a corner. And so they started acting like a wild beast and start just flinging things out there like more cuts, more spending, all this stuff. But in actuality, they just had to settle.
Yeah, but Reggie, I mean, you gotta agree, it was in part a politically ingenious move. I mean, what he did.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
On the president's part, absolutely.
Absolutely. I mean, he.
Diabolically genius.
What he basically managed to do, he managed to keep the status quo, throw something completely that wasn't on the table before, scare the living guts out of Republicans, and make them so afraid that they had to compromise on any value. I was about to say values. I'm sorry, Dr. K. That's not politically correct.
Yeah, especially when we're talking about these trillions of dollars in money just hosed out the window now. So.
Goodness.
Let's not say Republican values, but their bosses' values.
Their bosses'
yeah, or
Wall Street's values. But, I mean, if you look at it this way, I mean, the Republicans are back to step one, so you kind of look at it this way. It seems like Obama has definitely, if things go according to what it looks like it's going to happen, it seems like things have gone his way most of the time for this event. It seems like it's going to work out for him.
Well, it seems like it already did, and it felt like the president was never really backing off, and he repeatedly said he wouldn't negotiate. John Boehner came out of the White House, half a dozen times, furious, giving news conferences on the lawn of the White House, saying, you know, the president told me 20 times he just wasn't going to negotiate, and as it turned out, he didn't.
Dr. K, I don't mean to make Jordan even more rabid, because I hear him scratching the door, but to quote something I'm certain Jordan would say, the president, this has been voted on multiple times, he ran a presidency on this issue. So, I mean, the fact that he was not going to back down on this clearly demonstrate that he was a man of his word. Jordan, please, sit. Oh, my God.
We better take a break and call security because I'm afraid he's going to come through that window. A little break. We'll be back in a couple minutes. This is the Devil's Advocate on KTXT, The Raider.
Less conversation, a little more action, please. head. Grab your coat and let's start walking. Come on, come on,
come on, come on.
Come on, come on,
come on, come on.
Come on, come on,
come on, come on.
Hey, welcome back to the Devil's Advocate on the Raider 881 KTXT FM, coming to you live from the College of Media and Communication here at Texas Tech University. Matthew Riley from Political Sciences here, and our own College of Media and Communication student, Reggie Rutledge, is joining us.
Hey, what's up?
How's it going, guys?
So we're talking about the debt ceiling and the apparent deal, although it still has to clear the House, which is a big if. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next couple of days. But I'm a little concerned about Jordan, who's still trying to claw his way through the window. But we'll come back to that. So it's funny how the tone changes in Washington before and after things like this.
Oh, absolutely. Before this whole scandal really, really hit the man, it seemed like almost World War One style trench warfare, where you had your basic charge, which would gain you probably 2 miles, and that was considered a victory. I mean, this has basically been trench war to its core. It seemed like it didn't compromise whatsoever on either side, but now things are looking differently. But Roger, what do you think about the change in tone?
Now they're just throwing out the mustard gas, trying to clean up whatever's left.
So let's give a listen to the rhetoric before there was today's deal, and this is where you'll hear Reggie's mustard gas. What a great analogy.
This morning I had a chance to speak with Speaker Boehner.
As you all know, I had a phone call with the President of the United States this morning.
Having such a conversation, talks, negotiations, shouldn't require hanging the threats of a government shutdown or economic chaos over the heads of the American people.
I have to say I was disappointed that the President refuses to negotiate.
Let's stop the excuses. Let's take a vote in the House. Let's end this shutdown right now.
The President's position that, we're not going to sit down and talk to you until you surrender is just not sustainable. It's not our system of government.
The greatest nation on earth shouldn't have to get permission from a few irresponsible members of Congress every couple of months just to keep our government open or to prevent an economic catastrophe.
There's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit.
I'm not budging when it comes to the full faith and credit of the United States.
We can't raise the debt ceiling without doing something about what's driving us to borrow more money and to live beyond our means.
And this is the creditworthiness of the United States that we're talking about. This is our word. This is our good name. This is real.
I didn't come here to shut down the government. I certainly didn't come here to default on our debt.
We're not going to pay a ransom for America paying its bills.
This isn't about me, and it's not about Republicans. This is about saving the future for our kids and our grandkids.
If there's a way to solve this, it has to include reopening the government and saying America's not going to default, it's going to pay our bills.
So it's time to have that conversation. Not next week, not next month. The conversation ought to start today.
We can't make extortion routine as part of our democracy. Democracy doesn't function this way.
What the President said today was, if there's unconditional surrender by Republicans, he'll sit down and talk to us. That's not the way our government works.
Mr. President, the House Republican leadership's plan that is now out, and people have taken a look at it, it's a plan to advance an extreme piece of legislation, and it's nothing more than a blatant attack on bipartisanship. We've been working in good faith when I say that we felt blindsided by the news from the House. But this isn't the first time. Extremist Republicans and the House of Representatives are attempting to torpedo the Senate's bipartisan progress with a bill that can't pass the Senate, and won't pass the Senate. Out of spite, Tea Party Republicans are trying to take authority away from President Obama. They would never, ever consider doing this if it were President Romney, President Bush, or President Bush, or President
President Romney.
Or President Bush.
Or
President Bush.
So some harsh words. Yeah, I do catch a waft of mustard gas in the air still after that.
I found it extremely ironic that as soon as I made that analogy, I didn't even know, but the word surrender was mentioned, and it made my day.
Isn't that funny?
It's just... Man. The best humor is the one that just works. Serendipitous.
Serendipitous indeed.
I think we ended up with with surrender on one side anyway. So yeah, I'm detecting I feel a tremor in the force. I think it's coming from Houston. Reggie, what's going on in
gosh.
Houston?
You'll never believe this, but I'm reading something in the New York Times, and it says how the Houston Chronicle was actually sponsoring Ted Cruz for some time now.
Yeah, they endorsed him for Senate, as I recall, right?
Exactly. And now they're saying they wish he wasn't even on there. I'm just reading this, and I'm like, this is rich.
Oh, your Texas homeboy, gone. Junior senator losing support in Texas.
Well, he got what he wanted. He's got all the publicity he needs to run for presidency now. Who knows if he's going to get it?
Well, this is interesting because he's also already announced he will not filibuster this deal when it comes to the floor of the Senate.
Oh, thank God.
I could not take another reading of Green Eggs and Ham. Oh, my gosh.
That was fun. So it's interesting because I think Ted Cruz's strategy, actually, this is a little almost as diabolical as the president. The deal with Ted Cruz is I think he wants this to go to the House and for them to have the vote of last resort on this, and then his hands are clean because he can say, look, I fought the good fight. I did everything I could as a senator. The House let us down. I mean, that's the argument I think he's going to make now.
No, it's the good old political game of hot potato. You don't want to be the last one with that potato. No, it's
exactly.
It's going to do more than burn. But let's we've kind of talked about the notion of before this deal. What things have clearly changed. What do you guys think about this change? That it's very very complete, very polite conversation.
I hear violins now. I hear kumbaya being sung. Do you hear it? Let's give a listen to the rhetoric that started immediately today after this passed, and this is probably what put that huge smile on Jay Carney's face. Give it a listen.
The eyes of the world have been on Washington all this week, and that is a gross understatement. And while they witnessed a great deal of political discord, today they will also see Congress reach a historic bipartisan agreement to reopen the government and avert a default on the nation's bills. The compromise we reached will provide our economy with the stability it desperately needs. It's for two sides to reach consensus. It's really hard, sometimes harder than others. This time was really hard. But after weeks spent facing off across a partisan divide that often seemed too wide to cross, our country came to the brink of a disaster. But in the end, political adversaries set aside their differences and disagreements to prevent that disaster. I thank the Republican leader for his diligent efforts to reach this important agreement.
After yesterday's events, the Majority Leader and I began a series of conversations about a way to get the government reopened and to prevent default. I'm confident we'll be able to do both those things later today. Crucially, I'm also confident that we'll be able to announce that we're protecting the government spending reductions that both parties agreed to under the Budget Control Act and that the President signed into law. That's been a top priority for me and for my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle throughout this debate, and it's been worth the effort. Some have suggested that we break that promise as part of this agreement. Some have said Washington needs to spend more, that we need to raise taxes, that we need to just tax our way to prosperity and balance. But what the BCA showed is that Washington actually can cut spending. And because of this law, that's just what we've done. For the first time since the Korean War, government spending has declined for 2 years in a row. The first time in 50 years. Now it's time for Republicans to unite behind other crucial goals.
I'd just like to point out something real fast. I don't think Mitch McConnell is more so Huckleberry Hound as he is Droopy Dog. It just sounds like that to me.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. That's just brutal that he's talking about, you know, with great joy. First, how sad is it that in 50 years we've had spending cuts for 2 years in a row once? I mean, come on. That's just appalling.
And the last time we had these spending cuts was when we were at a state of war. Do we need another war to unite the nation? Apparently so.
He's just ridiculous. And then I love how Mitch McConnell's all excited about this deal that, hey, we
Wait,
got to
that,
keep.
That was excited? I really couldn't tell.
Yeah, he and Harry Reid both pretty darned enthusiastic.
Yeah,
McConnell's like, you know, talking with well, as much joy as he could muster about the keeping the sequester. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, the last time we had this fight, we had to fight tooth and nail. The two sides couldn't agree. The only way to get a spending cut was to force it. Remember, we had that committee of 12 people who were supposed to compromise. They couldn't negotiate a deal. That's why the sequester went in place in the first place. And so, you know, for him to be like gleeful that the president didn't get his extortion piece into this deal is kind of embarrassing.
I mean, I suppose it was just a political maneuver of Obama, like we sort of talked about before. I mean, it seemed to work out in the end. It seemed to have scared enough people. And even though I couldn't hear anything but death in his voice, I detected maybe a slight relief, perhaps. I don't know. I heard something.
Well, we'll see. You know, like I said, the next step is this has to go through the House. And, of course, the House Oof. Is, choose your word, the hornet's nest, the cesspool of conservatism up on Capitol Hill. Because other than Ted Cruz, there aren't many over on the Senate side.
What do you think, Dr. K? Predictions? You think it's going to pass?
I do, actually. I think it's going to pass. In fact, I've seen some references already in some newspapers that it's going to pass. And I think the House is just going to jump out of the way of the moving train. I also think you're going to get some principled votes from some people who are in really conservative districts or who ran as Tea Party members. I'll bet a couple dozen members vote against it, but just a couple dozen. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised. And again, not to besmirch our own congressman, but I suspect Congressman Neugebauer may vote for it. I just don't know. I mean, this is a very conservative district we're in. He hasn't run as a Tea Partier, so he's sort of, which is kind of funny, because if you know West Texas and this congressman in the district, to think he's actually to the left of some people who are up in Congress on Capitol Hill in the Tea Party. But, you know, I think a lot of people, I think it's going to vote, and I think it's going to pass easily in the House because they're all going to want to just get out of the way of the train.
Well, that's a dangerous strategy. I mean, especially with this this trustee-style representation. I mean, a lot of Republican constituents are going to be very upset with their congressmen, but apparently the polls demonstrate that most of the nation is, in fact, wants the government to cooperate. So it's up to the individual senators or House representatives decide whether they want to be a trustee and tell the people this is for your own good and this is for the good of the country, or they stick to their constituents' values and therefore I don't want to say lead to a default, but become a factor in a default. Reggie, my man, what do you think about this?
Ditto. No, I'm just kidding. It just depends, really. I mean, like you said, Obama got pretty much everything he wanted out of this entire engagement. Not really planned out as smoothly, but it was still effective in the fact that we did get to get major benefits out of this. So basically, throw out the sequester and increase spending, all things that could potentially go on to look better for Obama and the Democratic Party in the end.
Well, and see, he can make it sound like it was a compromise by keeping the sequester in place, even though it was absurd to even put that in play as a chess piece on this thing. But we'll see.
Yeah.
I did see in the Washington Post, I love the way they phrased this, the Republicans got another concession. So I missed this one earlier. The reason I missed it is it's smaller than the period typed on this page. So it says...
it's like the nutritional fact on one of those hard candies.
They put those on those? I've never seen it. It's that small.
Exactly. Or like a fine print in a contract.
Exactly. The Republicans got a promise from Democrats that people who receive subsidies because they're eligible because of their income being so low, that the government will actually check and make sure that their income is that low. So that's the one Affordable Care Act, Obamacare concession that Republicans got. I'm like, really? That wasn't already in place in the 2 billion words that are in that act? Come on.
I'm pretty sure they must have debated long hours into the night to get that one point. But I mean, it just seems like that's all Republicans are going to get in this deal, because if they've got their backs against the wall. I mean, most recent polls demonstrate that most people, while in fact they do blame They do blame Congress, but most of them believe it is the Republicans' fault. So their backs are against the walls, and they may have to give up more ground for them to get out of this one in one piece.
Well, and the president has the worst approval ratings he's ever had, 37%. In fact, that's lower than Bill Clinton's ever were. Even after the Lewinsky scandal, the Republicans are about half that.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, what is the approval rate of Congress right now? Have we reached the single digit yet, or are we still just at 10.1 or something?
Well, so Congress is 1%, but my personal congressman, he's all the way up to 9%.
For that, I'm actually going to quote one of my teachers, who was indeed a conservative. But he
a conservative
wait
professor?
In academia?
You'd be shocked, but yes. But what he said was, you can't really judge a president by what he's doing now, but instead you have to wait about like 10 years into the future and look back and evaluate everything he did.
I'm waiting for one of my students to come try that with me in class,
because so. I mean, like, even Clinton had a bad approval rating like at his time, but then 10 years later everyone's like, oh, he did so much good for the economy and whatnot.
You always look better after the fact.
Exactly.
It out that way.
Hindsight is always a good teacher,
yeah.
I always say.
5 or 10 years of heavy drinking, and it looks pretty darn good in retrospect. So real quick, the details of the deal, adding about $1 trillion to the debt limit and extending negotiations into mid-January, which, with all the financing tricks, will extend into February. So we'll get through the holidays, and then we'll be back in time in January to revisit this topic again. Let's take a break. We're going to come back and have a little fun and get to some other topics real quick. So we'll be back. Thanks for joining us on The Devil's Advocate here on KTXT-FM. Welcome back to The Devil's Advocate on KTXT, the Raider 881, coming to you live from the College of Media and Communication at Texas Tech University. Hey, so, you guys, you know what time it is?
Oh, boy.
Here we go. Boy.
It's time for the lightning round.
Thank God. I was worried the sound wasn't going to come on this time.
Epic Jorge. Jorge Macias with the sound. Love that. That never gets old, man. So we have some fun topics. First, the government did shut down, and you guys heard me lamenting this. I think the first week it was shut down, I said it was 20% of employees laid off, and I said that was actually not true and apologized because it was only 17%. It was about 700,000 people. It did affect some folks. I have a good friend who's in federal law enforcement who's been going to work, just not getting paid. Of course, lovely. He will get paid in on the backside, but some folks did lose their Hey, so we're going to talk about this, whether you think it's good or bad. A certain agency did not shut down, so...
I've got a hint. It's your favorite.
Yeah, I think I'll argue that it should have been shut down. What do you guys think? Anybody have a differing opinion?
I'll play a little devil's advocate. I'll argue that it shouldn't have been shut down.
So I'll start a clock here. 2 minutes. The agency that did not shut down due to the government shutdown, you guys can probably shout it out there in the audience listening to the radio. It was the IRS. Tax collection continued unabated through the 16 days of the government shutdown. Naturally. Of course, they did have to pay 80% of the government. I think that's appalling. I think if they're not going to pay anybody, they shouldn't be collecting any money. They can resolve that again after the fact. We never can seem to stop spending. There's just no way to do it. It drives me crazy.
What I want to know is who's in charge of making sure these cuts go across the board equally? Have the IRS not get cut or anything?
Yeah,
thank
you.
The wealthy businessmen of America may be dealing with this, but I mean, I'm going to quote something, and I'm pretty sure every man in the room has heard this quote before.
Careful now. Is this a sexist statement?
Gentlemen, all I have to say is death and taxes. That is all I have to say. Now,
only two things you can reliably count on.
But a bit more seriously, I mean, you can't expect the government to stop collecting taxes. I mean, Dr. K, what you're arguing is essentially what the Tea Party attempts to argue and fails miserably at arguing that taxes should not exist. And I mean, we have to have taxes. It's what keeps our infrastructure going. It's what keeps everything else going. I mean, regardless, we require these things to keep the basic functions of our society going. I mean,
very true, but to the degree of which you have to kick down people's doors and threaten them on the phone, I think we can cut some of that back a little bit.
We could have cut back 17% of the extortionary tactics
exactly.
of the IRS. So I think that would have been fair. All right. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Matthew.
No. I'm done. That's it.
Okay. Some fun. So we had another topic. Let's see. Which ones should we do the senator next, or should we do the really good one? We still have time. Let's do the senator
next.
Save
the best for last.
Yeah. Let's try that one. So, all right. Let's see if I can find this other one. We have a fun story. So a member of Congress. Sorry, I'm trying to find it. We had a member of Congress. A very, very wealthy member of Congress, actually.
$56.8 million, I believe.
Well, yeah, exactly. He's Frank Lautenberg, New Jersey, longtime member of Congress. There's a tradition in the House and the Senate when one of their members passes away, and Frank Lautenberg passed away not long ago. There's a tradition there where they take the congressman's salary and they pay 1 year's salary to the family surviving, which is a nice enough gesture. But during an argument over a government shutdown, et cetera, I don't know. What's interesting is Frank Lautenberg's wife got this payout, $174,000, even though he has left her, indeed, $56 million in his estate. So, again, I'll start the clock, but should she have gotten this payout or shouldn't she? I'm for the merciless Tea Party perspective, of course, which is let her starve on the $56 million, but that's just me. Reggie's having trouble mustering any sympathy for this guy.
I don't understand because... Maybe if it would work back in the days when governors didn't get paid that much money, but I don't even recall those days myself.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know how they get by on just $174,000. I mean, Texas Tech pays me a lot more than that, and I just get by.
That reminds me of some time when Romney said,
I'm lying,
I make speaking fees, but it's not that much.
Texas Tech doesn't pay me anywhere near that much. I don't want people lining up at the door.
We all know you're rich.
Going to meet me at the car.
Stop it right now.
Anthony Hall used to joke about my driver, and I'm like, come on. Really? I wish. Anyway, Frank Lautenberg. So, Matthew, what do you think?
Well, I think Why should she specifically be exempt? I mean, sure, she has the required money, but would the Congress really make it a big deal to impose special sanctions on people who do not require the money? I mean, how would that work out? Would Congress like set a limit? If you have a certain amount in the bank, are you no longer allowed to take a certain death gratuity? You would not be allowed to take that. I mean, the system just seems convoluted. I think it works perfectly fine the way it is.
Here's an irony. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, courtesy is all well and good, but I mean, at some point you have to draw the line. Maybe $100,000 is a bit too much for someone who's already making well over $1 million.
Well, so here's an irony. The Liberal Democrats, and Frank Lautenberg certainly counted himself among that group, they've called for means testing in any number of programs. They've wanted limits on payouts for, you know, Social Security withdrawals, how much goes to Social Security folks who have money, for student loans now that they've been federalized. And so all of those things have been means tested
Dr.
by Democrats.
K, you're done. Fair. You can stop now.
All right. Best topic of the day. I'll just jump in and start the clock. Where do we fall on this one? I'm going to side with Occupy Wall Street.
Oh my gosh.
This is as bad as that time Jordan claimed to support the IRA. Dr. K, somebody's going to bust the doors out, and it's not going to be Jordan.
Well, I don't know. So what has happened is Occupy Wall Street, you know, the famous movement from the park.
The terrorist organization.
That one, exactly. They've partnered with a prominent bank. It's backed by the FDIC. They've gone to this bank in New York, and they've cut a deal to have an Occupy movement prepaid credit card. I think it's remarkable. They've like teamed up. They've completely sold out.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Wow.
I mean, we may have to look forward to another 2008 housing crisis, except it'll be with the homeless now. Another housing crisis, another
homeless grad students.
Exactly. This is how we got to this point, by giving out mortgages to people who can't pay them back. This is exactly how it starts. You know this, Dr. K.
Well, exactly. You know, this deal gets even better, and here's why I'm all for it, because some people are going to make money, and if some of the Occupy Wall Street people like get a revenue stream here and actually get jobs so they don't have time to sit out in the park, I think this is a good idea. I'm all for it. But it gets more diabolical. There's a 99-cent monthly fee. It's $1.95 per transaction. I mean, this is a classic evil Wall Street banking card deal, and yet Occupy is hanging their name on it. It's fascinating to me.
The irony just absolutely astounds me.
The irony.
That they cannot. Well, and I don't want to be this guy, but quite frankly, the lack of insight on the occupiers is astounding. The fact that they cannot see that they are manipulating into this, I have no sympathy, but I believe, oh my goodness, I'm just going to let the clock run out. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable that they did it, and we've been sitting on that topic for a couple weeks. But yeah, we were just stunned when we saw, like, are you kidding me? Just the irony is the polite word. It's more like hypocrisy. So, I mean, it's just crazy that Occupy, of all things, would do it. And then fees. If you talk to an agent, if you need help with your card, there's a $2 fee. Walmart will let you load the card at Walmart's, but you're going to have to pay Walmart $3 or $4 to be able to have the privilege of doing that. So, all right, we're going to take another break. We'll come back in a couple of minutes, and I'm going to be joined by a couple other folks. We're going to talk about Wendy Davis and her hopeless gubernatorial hopes in the state. So stay with us, it's the Devil's Advocate here on KTXT.
Season ticket on a one-way ride.
Hey, welcome back to The Devil's Advocate. Dr. K here, welcoming you back. Join us on social media. You can be part of the conversation. Go to the Raider 881 on Twitter or also on Facebook/TheRaider881.
Beep, boop, beep, beep.
Reggie had to put down his video game for just a second. So Reggie's back joining us. We have a special panel, though. We're going to talk, as we've been discussing, about Wendy Davis. So Evan Dixon's joining us. Caitlin Osborne is with us for this segment. We have a special guest, Carolyn Heck, who has done a lot of reporting and is impassioned on this issue. And so she's going to join us. We're going to talk about Wendy Davis, who you may have heard of. We talked about her announcement last week. We had a little fun at her expense 2 weeks ago when Kathy Glass announced as the Libertarian candidate for Texas. So we actually have two women running for governor of Texas, neither of whom will become governor of Texas, but it'll be an interesting race to watch.
I feel like, you know, that's a counting your chickens before they hatch. Exactly. There's a possibility, you never, stuff could happen.
It could happen. So we'll see. Wendy Davis, of course, is famous for her 11-hour filibuster that came at the very, very end of the second special session when the House and Senate were convened to discuss the issue, the only special emergency topic that the governor saw fit in that session, which was actually the third session, which was to pass these new rights, which could be called either increasing safety for women seeking abortions.
There were actually other things in that session.
Okay, good. It wasn't the only one. In the third?
Yes. Okay. In the third and in the second, the filibuster actually blocked a lot of the other legislation that was supposed to pass that night.
That's right.
Evan was there, so he knows all about it.
Yeah, and Evan had
full disclosure.
What kind of stuff did they block in the
legislation? Oh, God. What else? I can't even think right now. I should know this.
Well, let's talk about, so that legislation basically made it a little harder, actually maybe a lot harder, for women to get an abortion in Texas. What it did is increase the requirements for physicians to have hospital privileges and access to hospitals. And so that's going to impede what was much easier access for women around the state. And of course, that's what Wendy Davis was filibustering. Carolyn, you have an interesting perspective because I think the huge issue that's going to earn Wendy Davis national support, national fundraising, is her support for abortion. But...
Well, I think that in Texas, a lot of people, it's a controversial issue. So her being in support for women's rights for abortion could very well be the thing that doesn't let her get elected. A lot of people are very passionate about it, including me.
Well, and what's funny to me is, and we were discussing this a little bit ago, that she's not really embracing it in a front and center way.
I looked on her website earlier today, and she had talked a lot about gun rights and immigration and jobs, but she made no mention of women's rights on abortions, which I thought was kind of funny because she spent 11 hours standing up for women's rights and then she doesn't mention it at all on her website.
Yeah, I don't really know her stance on any other issue but abortion. You know, in every news article basically I've read, they always bring it back to this issue. And so I feel like that's really going to overshadow her race for governor. You know, it's going to be like her main platform, even if she doesn't want it to be her main platform. That's what people are going to be talking about most of all.
Well, I mean, like, they could always edit the website, like, right before elections start and put, like, some of that key information on there.
But is that what she wants to be known for? Like, Wendy Davis is running for governor. She's against abortion. Like, does she want that to be her main platform? Is that what she wants to be known for? Is that what her main campaign is going to be? I mean, I feel that there needs to be a lot more besides just that.
I think she's going to do what a lot of other candidates have done, take a wild stance on something, and then when they get into a bigger race, they drop that that controversial stance to be more mainstream for people who are, you know, less worried about it.
Well, I think what's interesting this year in this race, I think we're looking at two races. Often in a race, you'll see candidates have to run in a primary first. They'll go hard to the right, hard to the left to win those voters. Wendy Davis has the luxury of starting right now, a year out, basically as the heir apparent of the Democrat nomination. I'm not even sure she'll have a challenger.
Right.
And so she can start running for the general election right now. While I think a lot of the Republicans are going to stake out very, very conservative Republicans. You know, I've shot and killed more animals than Greg Abbott.
Isn't he the heir apparent of the governorship, really?
I think there's some truth to that at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see if the two of them just go at it right away.
Well, I think that what's interesting to note is that there hasn't been a Democratic governor for Texas since Ann Richards, who was also the first woman governor Texas has had. And actually...
lost to George Bush in 1994, I believe.
I wouldn't know about that. Too young to vote. But what's interesting is that Ann Richards' daughter, Cecile, she's the president of Planned Parenthood, and she is now backing Davis. So even if Davis doesn't want, you know, the abortion issue to be her platform, the fact that she has this sort of backing, and also from a former governor of Texas, that kind of helps her in that area, I feel like.
I think being a woman and being in support of women's rights like she is, she won't really have much of a choice. I mean, a lot of women got really impassioned when she did her filibuster, when she was campaigning for their rights. So a lot of people are going to want her to stand up for that issue again.
But there's also a lot of women who are against abortion and are very passionate mm-hmm. about that. So it's really the question of, are there enough women and also maybe men in Texas who are willing to vote for her based on that issue? Or are there going to be enough people who are going to vote against her solely based on that issue?
Well, it's also interesting to note, I mean, being a conservative state, you'll have a lot more people to find a champion for pro or anti-abortion than you would for pro-abortion.
What I find interesting, though, is she's getting a lot of support from outside the state. So it kind of says, like, how much effect does she have, like, inside the state as well?
I think a provocative perspective on exactly what Reggie's saying is that she may draw resources, especially fundraising, maybe even volunteers, from races in other states that might be more competitive than hers is, and she may actually potentially hurt some Democrats around the country. I don't think that's going to happen in a big way, but it's a possibility.
Well, I feel that's a good point, because from what I've read, Davis has only raised $1 million for her campaign compared to Greg Abbott's $25 million. So if she could get fundraising from outside of Texas, you know, that could really help her campaign as far as, you know, advertising, PR, and also just getting the word out and, you know, maybe promoting other platforms besides anti-abortion.
So, Evan, you weren't looking down on this from the gallery. You were looking up at the gallery.
That's correct.
And so yes. Tell us a little about that experience.
Well, for full disclosure, I actually I work for Senator Duncan's office. I was an intern there during the session, work here in his district office now.
And you told me Robert Duncan, I think, at one point was holding the gavel during the filibuster.
He was. That was a big surprise, especially for the staff.
Evan was that close to
power. We did something like that. Yes. If anyone had power that night, I don't know who did. It was...
The gallery did.
I guess so, yes, in some ways. It was an interesting night, yeah.
Well, quick history. She got bagged. The rules in Texas are you can't read from Dr. Seuss, for example, in the Texas Senate when you're filibustering.
Correct, yes.
That'd be great if we could. I can't imagine what she would read.
You know, I think
Harry Potter or something.
You could have tied that around. Yeah, Harry Potter if you want to.
Or play Pokemon.
You have to stay on topic, and they bagged her 3 times for going off topic, and I've talked about this before on the show. I thought it was terribly ungentlemanly of the Republicans to bag her for getting help with her back brace. Go ahead, Evan.
I think that's all very interesting just because of what the rules actually say and what ended up happening. Certainly, I could go into that more, but...
Well, real quick, her third violation, theoretically
right.
ending the filibuster, came
by
almost
Senator
an
Campbell.
Hour before the deadline,
yes.
midnight.
Yes, by Senator Campbell.
They got very, I feel like they got very nitpicky as far as, you know,
I think someone was just looking for something to end the filibuster
exactly.
at that point.
And I heard staying on topic, I mean, I've heard that people trying to do a filibuster have sat there and read from a phone book instead of actually staying on topic. So why would they tell her, oh, no, you have to stay on topic when, I mean, they're just reading down this giant book?
Well, it's different from state and national.
Right, the rules are different in Texas. What's important is the filibuster ended just after 11 with a deadline of midnight, but they still could not get legislation passed. And Evan, tell us more about that.
Right. So about, I guess it was 11:10 that Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst, or the President of the Senate Dewhurst, decided that it might have actually been 10:30. I can't remember the timeline. That he decided that she had 3 violations and she no longer had the floor. That then caused basically a parliamentary procedure filibuster by ended up being by both parties in some ways, just because no one really knew what was going on. And then, of course, we all saw the footage of about 11:30 on, the crowd and that had sat there since 8 a.m. very quietly, all of a sudden,
mad rioting.
Basically, were rioting. They were. It was very loud. It was. I have never been on the field during a game at Texas Tech for football, but that's what I imagine it being like. You couldn't talk to the person next to you and hear each other.
I can't imagine that. That would just stress me out too much.
Yes, especially in a place that's usually very quiet and reserved, and obviously much more pomp and circumstance.
There are 31 members of the Texas State Senate, and there were many hundreds of people in the gallery.
Yes.
So it must have been intimidating.
And I can imagine people got pretty, or tried to get pretty violent and everything like that.
That was the tough part. I think the Department of Public Safety was not really, no one really ever imagined that they would get as loud as they did, so they really weren't prepared to clear the gallery or anything of that nature.
But it shows that people actually care about the issue a lot, and there are plenty of anti-abortion activists, you know, who support Wendy Davis, and, you know, just that evidence alone shows that, you know, she could get a very good candidacy for governor. So,
Dr. K, you want to sign us out?
Yeah, the passion is there. It'll be interesting. Hey, thanks for joining us for this week's episode of The Devil's Advocate. We'll be back, as always, next Wednesday at 5. Come back and join us. And again, join the conversation.
Thanks, guys.